Welcome to the Vancouver International Film Festival podcast, a podcast dedicated to some of the most exciting live conversations that happen at the festival and our year-round program. I'm your host, Ken Tsui, Director of Creative Engagement and Live Programming here at the festival. And in this episode, we present Oscar and Emmy-winning director, author, and activist Michael Moore. In 1989, Michael Moore burst onto the American film scene with his groundbreaking documentary, which chronicled the efforts of General Motors to turn his hometown of Flint, Michigan, into a ghost town. Little would our programming team know that this unsolicited submission would go on to win the festival's Most Popular Film Award. We're thrilled to welcome him back for an anniversary screening of the film and to talk during the Vancouver International Film Festival, moderated by Stephen Quinn, the host of the early edition on CBC Radio 1.
How are you?
I actually regretted sitting in here watching it. I'm sorry to say that. I thought this felt like the best place to watch it again after all these years. It was too hard. And I have attempted to watch it a number of times. I can't really get through it. And I'm like, damn, what is wrong with you? So when I just left now while you were all relieving yourselves, I'm not ashamed to admit this. I went downstairs and just cried. So I feel better now, getting that out of me. But I think everybody in here is watching it with context, many contexts, the obvious context of what the United States has become, but also what everyone in here knows what Flint means now in the 21st century, and that the people who couldn't get those U-Hauls and get out, who were left behind, ended up being poisoned. And it's not an environmental issue. The water from Lake Huron was clean, and they cut that off because profit-making venture had convinced many communities in Michigan to buy into a new pipeline they were going to build. And because Flint, the governor of Michigan, had removed the mayor under a new law that allowed the governor to take over a city, because the city was poor and broke. So the new governor signed on to this profit-making pipeline. And while they're building the pipeline, they'd have to take Flint off the port, the Lake Huron water, and have people start drinking from the Flint River, which is just a cesspool. It's not even... to dignify it by calling it a river is not right. And so, you know the rest of the story. And no one's been arrested and convicted yet in the state. And the Republican governor is term limited, so he left in January this year, but he remained on. So every child got lead poisoning. Lead in children, especially under the age of six, causes permanent irreversible brain damage. There's no medicine to take. There's no therapy for it. They are damaged for the rest of their lives. And a whole bunch of things happen with that, most notably, actually, the average IQ goes down 20, 30 points. When they become adolescents, as your brain matures and as you deal with issues so that anger doesn't rule the day when you're an adult, that whatever that process is in the brain that filters it.
Self-regulation.
Is not there. And so you have adolescents then who are angry, potentially violent, etc. And this never could have happened in Bloomfield Hills or Grosse Pointe or Ann Arbor. It happened because, it could happen because the city is majority black and poor. The white people who are there are very poor. So anyways, so to watch something about Flint, if I were to show this in Flint today, people would look at this as, wow, those were the good old days. Because when I made this movie, General Motors had 80,000 workers in Flint, and we'd lost 30,000 jobs. So when I made this movie, there were still 50,000 people working for General Motors. Today, there's 6,000 left.
On strike as well.
Huh?
On strike.
And on strike, well. Yes, of course. The first thing that the CEO of GM did when the strike happened a couple of weeks ago was to cut off the health benefits. The CEO is a former resident and the first CEO of GM to have ever worked on an assembly line and lived in Flint and raised her family in Flint. Yeah, did I say her? Yes, she's a woman. Did this to these workers. And so it just all goes part and parcel into the whole thing. And where's my family at somewhere? There you are, okay. We were sitting there and I'm just like, I leaned over to my sister and I said, when Pat Boone says capitalism, praising it, of course, I said, that's the first time that word is used in all of my films. All of these films to me are, I hope someday, maybe after I'm gone, that will be seen as a 20-hour movie about how an evil economic system destroyed the people of a particular country and the country itself and possibly the world. But I was just happy that Pat Boone is the first to utter the C word.
You do see the seeds of all of your later films sort of planted in this film. This is the first sort of study that, you know, you continue much with the same method, digging into more specific topics as you go. I want to ask, this is a creator talk. Can I just say, I'm way more sad at the end of that than I thought I would be too. When I saw it on screen 30 years ago, I left the feeling with a very different feeling because it's very funny. There are parts of it that are very, very funny. Overall, my recollection wasn't that I would feel awful at the end of it. Is that context? Is that because the context of America and the economic system you talk about has changed over 30 years?
I think, again, part of it is that. I realized sitting there just now why the humor that is in the film mm-hmm. was there for me, really, more than for the... I thought for the audience, because I didn't... I understood that for what I was trying to say in the film wasn't going to work if I just beat people over the head and have them, at the end of the film, be depressed. And, you know, I used to say, you know, in the edit room, we don't want people... The feeling at the end of the film shouldn't be, I need a drink. The irony that we're all going to drink after...
I think it's a pretty good idea, actually, man.
But I realized that, and I know this just from my own Irish-Canadian-American roots, that the humor that I grew up with, I always saw it as the flip side of the coin, that on the other side of the coin were a lot of angry Irish people.
I grew up around them as well.
Okay, so you know what I'm talking about. And I think I learned at an early age, too, that the only way to alleviate this anger and despair and the sort of dark view of the world was either to have develop a sense of humor or to drink or both.
Or to put on a Tommy Makeham album, I think, was the one. That exactly. Means nothing to people who aren't Irish.
But it's Yeah, if you know any Irish, but I also say this about Canadians, because I saw watching Channel 9 from Windsor, which we could pick up with a simple antenna in Flint, very, very clear signal, that the Canadian sense of humor was not ours. And while these people seemed to look like us, and at least in Ontario, they spoke English and whatever, they weren't us. And that they dealt, I think, with their anger through humor, as did the Irish and the British and the Scots. If you've traveled at all, or you have any friends in other places, you see that the darkness is, we're always trying to lift the darkness from us. And alcohol alone won't work. In fact, it actually doesn't work. It makes it darker. I think it's also what's kept us alive, and it's kept the fight in us too. And I think that all jokes aside, that I said at the beginning here, I'm referring to Canada, I believe that that fight is in a lot of people here too. But I think the context that you refer to is because if you are over the age of 50, you grew up in a time in the 60s and 70s where we were absolutely convinced we were going to make this world a better place. We were going to throw out the bums, the people who were making life miserable for all of us. And we were going to leave our kids and our grandkids with a far, far better place. And sitting there in the, you know, fifth row of this theater gave me the feeling of a real sense of failure, that that our generation didn't do that. We've left them with a worse planet, no doubt about that. And it, the sense that we, the hippies, the love and peace generation, didn't succeed, as we now enter our years where we're going to be the elders, has got to be pretty damn depressing to anybody, either watching this film or thinking about how far we haven't gone that we should have been by now. And that, I hope, if anything, because I'm not depressed watching this. I sat there with a fire being lit under me again and a rage that is healthy and productive.
I felt very much the same way. It wasn't just sadness. It was also a lot of anger at the injustice. How do you harness that now?
Nonviolently. Yeah. Nonviolently. All right, sorry.
Yeah, no. And specifically, what do you mean?
There was somebody who objected to the nonviolence, and I can't see him. Oh, okay. All right. He's. Are you American or Canadian?
My mother was American, but I'm Canadian.
Okay. All right. Because he said he was apologizing because he couldn't hear me, and but then I thought, yeah, but you hear, you can go get help. And you need dental, too, by the way. Not you personally, but I'm just saying.
It's kind of an issue around here these days.
It's an issue here?
Well, we are, of course, in the middle of a Canadian election campaign. We vote on the
Is anybody 21st. In favor of dental care?
Yes.
Oh. Is there a party?
There is. The New Democratic Party is promising to include dental care. The Green Party is as well.
The Green Party is?
Yes.
Okay. What about the Liberals?
No.
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 Yeah, that's a bridge too far for the Liberals.
Universal health care should stop in your mouth. Is the my 15-year-old calls his teeth luxury bones.
It's the problems often start in the mouth.
I know,
right? I mean, it's like it's so crazy. Malcolm Gladwell wrote a great piece on this like 10, 15 years ago about actually, if we had to choose between dental care or medical care in the U.S., we should first try to get dental care because of all the health problems and economic problems and how capitalism punishes you if you have bad teeth. So if you grow up with bad teeth as an adult, you don't get the better jobs, you make a lot less money. There's all these stats that Gladwell showed that not having a dentist from the time you're a child on is harmful physically, it's harmful economically, et cetera. So, so the NDP and the Green Party support that.
That's correct.
Yeah.
No one knows how it will be paid for.
And I assume the liberals say, you know, how can we pay for it, right? We can't pay for it. We'll have to tax people.
That's
the usual Hillary Clinton kind of, you know. For my last film, I interviewed her campaign chair, John Podesta. And I said to him, what is wrong with you people that you just can't say free health care? Well, you know, we didn't know if we could, how we had to show how we could afford it. I said, afford it? We're Americans. We don't ever stop to think of, can I afford this? We go to Target every weekend and we buy shit. You're talking to an American public who just buys shit and never thinks about whether we can afford it. You put it on the card. You just say it when you're running. You just say free dental. Trudeau just needs to say free dental and worry about it later. You know, if he'll have 3 or 4 years to try to make it happen. If he doesn't, then they'll throw him out then. But at least buy some time. And tell people you're going to fix their friggin' teeth. I don't know what is wrong with these politicians that call themselves liberals.
The excuse I hear.
I said to Podesta, just say it. I want practice right now. Say free healthcare. Say free college. Free college. Say it. I'm sick of losing. Just fucking say it. Trump went to Michigan numerous times, went to Wisconsin numerous times, and he just kept saying, you know, I'm bringing your jobs back.
Yep.
That's all you want to hear. I'm bringing your jobs back. And he kept saying, I'm going to tax the hedge fund guys. And everybody would cheer at the rallies. And it's like, it didn't matter whether he meant it. It just mattered that he said it. You know, if I said to this guy over here, I said, sir, you, for your age, you actually look really good. Like for a second right there, you just thought, oh, wow, that's kind of nice. It doesn't matter if it's the truth. I just told 700 people, you look fucking good. That's all that matters. What is wrong with liberals? I'm sorry.
No, you said this in an episode of Trumpland. You said exactly this, that the reason people voted for him was because he was going to, he went to the people of Michigan and he said, I am going to put, unless GM or unless the automakers move their plants back to America, I'm going to slap a, what was it, 35% tariff on their cars. And the collective, you know, sigh of admiration and joy that went out across all of the workers of middle America was huge, and that's the reason they would vote for him and it would feel good for a day, you said.
But right now, I take one day of just feeling good.
Yeah.
I mean, that's...
Not today?
I'll feel better when we go over to the library square.
I have to say, this is a creator talk, and I would love to let you just go on. I mean, do we want to talk about the movie, or do we want to? I have some.
When I heard, first of all, I love the name Creator Talk.
Yes.
The godlike nature.
You are the creator.
It's not a Canadian word.
No.
So it's like, you know, it's it has no humility to it at all. I am the creator of this movie. But, oh, it just made me think of something, too. So I was watching one of your channels last night, and on came a commercial for a company called, I think it's called Medipack, and it's so polite. They're probably worried that Americans will see these ads when they visit here, but it's all about when you travel to the States, you must get a private health care plan for the days or weeks you're going to be in the States.
Yes.
Because your BC health card is not going to cover you if you get into some serious shit down there. So how many of you, when traveling to the States, have had to get a little, look at this. Yes. I wish Americans could see this. Like, it will not enter the United States without extra coverage.
I won't go skiing at Mount Baker for a day without getting extra coverage.
Wow. So, but this, the woman on the ad said, and in addition to covering you, if you get sick in the States, in addition to covering you, we'll make sure that we return you safely to your home in Canada.
It really makes the United States sound like a leper colony.
How will the Canadians get back home? Crawling. Where's my crutches? You know, when I'm on this TV show I had called TV Nation, we did a thing called the Healthcare Olympics. This is in 1993, 94. And we got two sportscasters, Bob Costas and Ahmad Rashad, to do the play-by-play, and this was all real, so it's all documentary, none of it's set up. So I asked three hospitals if I could place a camera crew in the emergency room and follow a patient as they go through the process, or as you say, process. And and I said, okay, it has to be a broken arm or a broken leg.
Right.
So there's apples to apples in the three hospitals. So one hospital was in Fort Lauderdale, Florida. One hospital was in Toronto. And one hospital was in Havana, Cuba.
Yes.
It took a full day because you're going to get a broken bone in each of these hospitals. We filmed the whole thing from beginning to end. And the end would be the accountant, you know, the cashier as you check out. Yeah. How much did this cost you? So the American bill for a broken arm was something like, I don't know, $1,000 and some. In Toronto, it was free for the broken leg, except they made the guy pay $10 for his crutches. This is how they take away your social safety net. One crutch at a time.
Oh, it's just crutches. It's only $10.
It's only $10. Bo doesn't have $10. Canadian. Come on. But in Havana, it was entirely free, including the crutches. So, Cuba won. And we filmed this whole thing with Bob Costas, you know, declaring Cuba the winner. We had a medal ceremony, you know, the whole thing. Canada got the silver and the U.S. shouldn't have even got the bronze. But anyways, I get a call from the censor, who's called Standards and Practices at NBC. And she says to me, I'm sorry, Cuba can't win. I said, what do you mean? It's Standards and Practices. We cannot have on primetime television in the U.S. you showing Cuba. I said, oh, come on. It's all documentary. It's all verified. Yeah. They won. No. We had this fight for a couple of weeks. They would not air it. And finally she says, look, we're either going to kill the piece or you're going to change it to Canada winning. So I didn't want to kill the piece. So if you ever see it, I think it's online, you'll see Canada winning. You did not win.
How did you get around the $10 for crutches? How did you justify Canada winning when Cuba was?
How did they justify? And the network said they won. I said the people, that guy had to pay $10 for the crutches. Canada didn't win. You know, Canada. This is a problem with Canada. It's like we're gonna go all the way, except we're not. We're just gonna. We're going to take care of our native people, except, well, we're not. It's just like, yeah. I don't mean to be critical, but I'm just saying.
No, be critical. Know. Go ahead.
Well, no, it's no American should ever open their mouth criticizing Canada for anything. You know, seriously. You can criticize yourselves and what's going on here? Mm-hmm. You know, you did give your Native people a beautiful sheet of ice. I will grant you that. That is a... No, but I don't want to be, I don't want to be critical. So you got quiet. It's like...
So how's everything in America now? Is it everything... Everything...
No, the funny thing...
Going well, is it?
If I had been here the first weekend of this festival, and you'd asked me that,
yes.
I would have said, if the election were held today, I'm sorry to tell you, Trump is going to win again. Mm-hmm. The popular vote, I hate calling it the popular vote. You know, in a democracy, whoever gets the most votes wins. You understand that, right? Okay. Okay, well, not in the U.S., as you know.
Not here either. And,
well, actually not. Yeah, yes, right. Yeah, I wouldn't want this system either. I'll tell you what I would like, voting on a paper ballot. Mm-hmm. You haven't switched yet to computers, have
no.
you?
No.
Don't. New Brunswick, f*** them. Always thinking that they're the, you know, innovator. All the great Canadian inventions come from New Brunswick. That big Canada arm on outer space, New Brunswick probably claims that's theirs. It's a huge step backward. Don't ever let it happen here. You've seen enough now with us to know never give up the paper ballot and the number two pencil. And counting the ballots in the elementary school on the table at 8 o'clock in front of poll watchers from each of the parties.
Yep.
That's how you do it. It doesn't take any longer. You're the second largest country on Earth, landmass-wise.
Yes.
And by 11 o'clock, by 8 o'clock in the Pacific zone, mm-hmm. by 11 o'clock back east, you know pretty much, right, who your prime minister is.
Yes, unfortunately.
And you've got to bring those ballots in, but you've got to bring them in from, you got to, you're, they're coming in on dog sleds.
There are phones. then they call the number in.
There are phone lines even
yeah.
running water.
What do you think is going on? Unless you live on a reserve. So you're thinking differently now than you were a couple of weeks ago about whether Donald Trump is going to be elected in 2020, and that obviously resulted in the impeachment inquiry.
Yeah, even 2 weeks ago, I thought. Whoever the Democrat is next year, Hillary won by 3 million votes. The Democrat next year will win by 4 to 5 million. There's no doubt about that. No about that. Well, yes, I mean, Bernie most resembles my personal politics. And I like, you know, Elizabeth Warren, I filmed her for the first time back in 2005 for Sicko, and then for mm-hmm. Capitalism, a Love Story, she appeared again. So I was, you know, I've known her for a long time and impressed, and I wish that she would quit saying that I'm a capitalist to my bones, because you're not. I mean, if you're thinking Adam Smith capitalism, maybe, where he said that capitalism wouldn't survive if it didn't have a moral core to it, if it didn't take care of people.
Right.
But that's not what we live in now. We live in a very greedy system that they call it capitalism, but so I'm disappointed that she uses that word because she knows better. And you know, Bernie just doesn't give a shit. He's just going to say whatever he thinks and feels, and you know.
Why?
And it was a heart attack. Did
yeah,
you hear that this morning?
Yeah, I heard that. Yeah. Why was this the thing? Why was a phone call to Ukraine the thing that finally got the Democrats to do this? Why wasn't it, I don't know, putting kids in cages or lying about everything or gross mismanagement? Or why was it this?
Or being a sexual predator.
Oh, there's that, yeah.
It was already reaching a tipping point, I think that the Ukrainian phone call is so easy to understand, and you watch enough of our TV to know that if you explain it in a matter that's you know, easy to understand. People get it. You know this about us, okay, that we're good people. We are. You've met enough of us to know that we're decent people. We might be slower learners than you are. I remember whenever we go to visit our Canadian relatives near London, Ontario, and we were always like, oh no, because it would be so bored while we were there because their walls were lined with books. And they read so many books here. But we are when we finally get it, when we finally realize that we've been lied into invading Iraq, right? Bush gets elected in 2004, but in the 2006 election, we take over the House and the Senate. Within 2 years, it took a while for Americans. Bush had a 70% approval rating. 70% of the country supported the war. 29 Democrats in the U.S. Senate voted for the war, including Hillary and John Kerry and Joe Biden. And but 2 years later, two years after the 2004 election, that was the beginning of the end for them. And two years after that, a country that still is quite racist in many ways did something that you won't do in my lifetime, elect a black person as the president of the United States. That I would live long enough to see that in such a country filled with millions of vile, racist people had a profound impact. And if there's any Americans in here that, okay.
Security.
I'm just saying that that night in 08, everybody was seriously moved that things would be better. It's why, if I could just skip ahead to now, that when those first photographs of Justin Trudeau appeared a few weeks ago, people in the U.S., the non-racist people, the good people, the majority, were crushed, absolutely crushed, because the way we see him is out at the airport welcoming refugees. The way we see him is having that lunch with Obama in the diner. That once we went from Obama to Trump, the level of despair, but also envy toward you, that you had him, not a hater, and that we are going to have to live with this. So when that happened, it was pretty, it's like you just, I mean, my first thought was, my first thought actually was, what is wrong with white people? I mean, no, seriously. But, you know, and I mean, he explained it. He said, I'm a person of privilege. I was raised with white privilege. And where I don't think at that age you would have done that. I certainly wouldn't have done that. But, you know, this is a guy that got elected because he beat the crap out of somebody in the ring. You know, I mean, you elected a guy who loves snowboarding. I mean, there's the yin with the yang here. I mean, you get a lot of good, and then you get the other stuff that you want to maybe turn away from. But
we'll find out on the 21st whether there's any coming back from that. Do you think there's coming back from that? Do you think that it's over for him as a result of that?
It's hard for me to say. I don't live here.
Yeah.
And you don't have, you have racial issues here.
But not the history.
You don't have that history.
Yeah.
That particular history. So I don't know. Mm. I think if I lived here, obviously I'd vote for the guy who actually wears a turban mm-hmm. because that's his belief in his life. But you see, I just saying that, I thought, you know, we don't like it. Americans don't like it when people interfere with our elections. So for me to sit here and try to even say anything about yours doesn't quite feel right.
Right.
But I appreciate the irony that we as far as interfering in elections, we are the inventors. We are the origin story of our CIA manipulating elections all over the world for decades. And when someone's democratically elected, staging coups or assassinations to take them out. So for us to get our underwear in a bunch over the fact that the Russians or whatever messed around with us
right.
in 2016, yes, of course, nobody should be messing with our elections. But let's at the same time just remind people that we came up with that idea first. So
I do want to open this up to questions from the audience. We have just a few minutes to do that. We have people with microphones, and I will, as judiciously as possible, choose the people. So if you'd like to raise your hand, someone with a mic will come to you. We'll just take front and center here first, if we can.
I forget if it was MSNBC or on Bill Maher, you had predicted a year or two before the election that Trump had a huge possibility, and you were laughed at.
I was laughed at and booed, and I didn't say he had a huge possibility. 6 months before the election, I said that Trump is going to win, and he's going to win by winning Michigan, Wisconsin, and Pennsylvania, three blue states. So I think at the casino, when you're able to actually call, not just say win, but call the three states, you get something for that little.
So my question is,
I never wanted to be more wrong. I mean, that's just, it was an awful thing to say and upset people. But I was trying to tell them, don't take this for granted. Just because she's one of the smartest people ever to run for president of the United States doesn't mean anything, because this guy knows how to read a room and sell what he's selling to an unsuspecting audience.
So my question is now, what are people laughing at you for now that you think they'll be biting their tongue about?
You did predict the 2018 midterms wouldn't have the greatest turnout in a century, and they did. And you've also called Donald Trump the last president of the United States.
I stole that from Stephen Colbert, just to be
But that was a comment. I mean, that was a comment on the fragility of democracy.
It's very fragile, and democracies don't last. And if we have this attitude that it's always going to be with us, or that the Constitution, the sacred Constitution, is going to protect us. Your question, though, about what are they laughing at now, or what don't they want me on the air to talk about? This is a recurring problem with me, and the Democratic Party works overtime. Various people who work as adjuncts to the Democratic Party or leadership of the Democratic Party do their best to try to keep me off TV, try to put it out there that, you know, this is not good for us to have me out there. I met with Steve Bannon last year privately. I wanted him to appear in my film, Fahrenheit 11/9, and explain how they figured out how to win the election by losing it. Because I know no liberal could ever figure out how can we get less votes by the millions, but still be given the keys to the Oval Office. No liberal I know is smart enough to figure that out. So I wanted to know how they, the evil geniuses, figured that out. How'd they pull that off? I could not convince him to go in front of the camera, but I spent an hour and a half with them. And he said to me, I want to tell you something. I was at the, before you went to Toronto with Roger and me, there's this little festival, Telluride, mm-hmm. That's kind of an exclusive thing. It's not really open to the public. It is and it isn't, you know. And he said, I was there for the very, very first screening of Roger and Me. I sat right behind Roger Ebert. I said, where was it? He goes, Mason's Hall. I said, you were in the room? I was just two rows behind you. This is 30 years ago. And Steve Bannon is sitting there. I said, what? He said, honest to God, I walked out of there so upset. I'd always thought that the populist revolution in the United States would come from the right. And I walked out and I found a phone booth, because we didn't have phones back then. And I called a friend back in D.C. and I said, you're not going to believe what I just saw. This is the worst thing that's ever happened to us. The populist revolution is going to come from the left in the U.S. And I just met the guy who's going to lead it. He's just, some guy from Flint, Michigan. And he said, I just went on and on about, I was just so depressed for days. And never did I think that the Democratic Party would do our work for us and try to make you, try to marginalize you, not listen to you. Our greatest gift really in 30 years has been that the Democrats have never listened to you, because you've been right on all these issues. You were right. There were no weapons of mass destruction in Iraq. You were right. General Motors and the industrial way that things were running was going to collapse. You know, everything you've said, and each time you do it, they fight you. And it was hard to listen to that because I knew the truth of it. Beto O'Rourke, 2 weeks ago at the debate, 3 weeks ago at the debate in Houston, looks into the camera and says, we're going to take away your AR-15s and your AK-47s. The very next hour, the Democratic Party was dispatching pundits to be on all the talk shows for the next morning to walk back what he said, because they thought, oh my God, we're going to lose the election. He told everybody, we're going to take your guns away. And so they put Democrats out there trashing Beto O'Rourke for what he said. But if you watch the debate, when he said it, it's the only moment in the debate when the entire audience rises to its feet and cheers him. And what in Texas? But the Democratic Party doesn't even know its own country, doesn't even know its own people, and wanted to trash Beto O'Rourke, and they did for the next week. But you see, the Democrats are idiots in this way. And here's who's not idiots: corporate America. Within a week, Colt Manufacturing, Colt Guns, announced they were discontinuing selling the AR-15 to the public. It was like, wow. I know why. He said it. No Democrat had ever dared to say it. Once it gets said, that's where the avalanche starts. Somebody has to burn the first draft card. Somebody has to burn the first bra. Somebody has to be the first person to walk down from one end of the mall at Sears all the way down to JCPenney's, holding the hand of the person you're in love with, who just sadly happens to be of your gender. Whoever did that for the first time in whatever town you're in, shitting bricks the whole way, thinking someone's going to come up and clobber them, somebody has to do it. Beto said it. Once the genie's out of the bottle, and Colt knew this, they said, fuck, we better give them something, or they're going to come for all our guns. So let's give them this. That'll shut the conversation down. So smart. And the Democrats, all they were thinking of is the sorry election they thought they were going to lose, because their fellow Americans, who they don't even know. Let me tell you who the American people are. You think we're a nation of gun nuts? Yeah. 78% of Americans do not own a gun. 78%. There are 300 million guns in people's homes. But the Washington Post did this study, and they found out that 3% of the American public owns over 150 million of the guns are owned by just 3%. Now that's some scary shit, because 3% have built an arsenal for what they perceive to be the coming civil war. But the truth is, our fellow Americans, they're not even gun owners. Of course they stood and cheered to get rid of the AK-47s and the AR-15s.
The fact, you haven't started this in Canada, have you, where your kids go through active shooter drills? Have you started this here?
They're not called active shooter drills, but we do have lockup practice in classrooms.
Stop!
And codes.
Stop! It's the worst thing to put a 7 or 8 year old through. What are you telling them? You know, it's so wrong on so many levels. It's the first step to acquiescing to the fact that, well, you know, we live in a violent society, so we better prepare the kids. Well, how about this idea? The one of the kids who's going through the active shooter drill is the potential future shooter. So for years, did I say he?
You did.
He has watched how the active shooter drill works. He knows where the hiding places are. He knows the drill. He knows the whole deal. You know, we used to do tornado drills. The tornado didn't know.
Does that answer your question, sir?
Okay, my other answers will be shorter because I'd like to fit in as many questions as possible.
I'm getting told that's the end of the question period, unfortunately.
In a free society, there can't be just one question.
We've already heard enough from the Canadian-American guy here, down here. You, ma'am. There's a good closer. Who's going to be the next president of the United States?
If there's a microphone at the bar, I'll take a few more questions. they'll be better with alcohol. So, who's going? I don't know. I don't know. Who would win tonight? I don't know. I don't know. You know who I would like to win of the ones that are running, but for the question is, how can we guarantee? Because I believe. Bernie will beat Trump. Elizabeth can beat Trump. Kamala Harris can beat Trump. Biden can beat Trump. Buttigieg could probably beat Trump. I think there's a number of people that can beat him, but Hillary beat him. Beating him is not the point. Beating him is not enough. He has to be crushed, and I mean crushed. So who... who is the American... that would crush him tonight? And I think there's one very obvious person to me, and her name is Michelle Obama. She would, people love Michelle Obama. She would crush him. And I know you're thinking, well, she doesn't want to go back there. But you know what? When your country is in danger, you have to serve. Wouldn't each of you, if Canada was under some sort of threat, wouldn't you, okay, you're not fit to go into the army or whatever, but wouldn't you take, if your government asked you to use your skill to protect Canada from the United States, who wouldn't in here do whatever you could do? And I know this sounds awfully arrogant of me to say to Michelle Obama, because she's given so much, but she just has got to go back for 4 years. And run things, and you only have to do one term. So, the kids are raised, they're off to college. You know, we'll all eat vegetables. I'm willing to commit to so much right now. Vegetables for Michelle. I would put my name at the top of the donor list for a pancreas for Ruth Bader Ginsburg. You know, I mean, I would just... I've lived long enough. I've had a good life. She has to live till 2021. There's no way around it. I don't know.
But...
No, I want to live. Actually, I take
that. I don't want to cut you off mid-sentence, but we have to wrap it up. And
so, how do we? What's the deal on going to this bar?
It's kitty corner. How are you going to figure out? Because it's not going to fit everybody.
Everybody gets a drink ticket there. Yeah. If too many show up, we'll all take turns wandering in and out of the door, right? All right.
Michael Moore, ladies and gentlemen.
Peter Quinn, thank you. Thank you very much. Thank you, everybody.
Thanks for listening to this conversation recorded live from the Vancouver International Film Festival. Be sure to subscribe so you don't miss an episode. Creator Talks and Masterclasses are programmed by Fran Bergen. The podcast is created by Ellen Hadley and Clem LeBay on the unceded territories of the Squamish, Musqueam, and Tsleil-Waututh Nation.